So thanks again for joining me today. Can you just so everyone knows who you are, can you just tell us your name, where you work, and what it is that you study?
My name is Miriam Holman. I'm an associate professor of political science at Tulane University, and I study gender and politics, local politics, state level politics. I often investigate questions around representation and policymaking.
Okay, and where are you right now? Where in the world are you right now?
I'm in New Orleans, in my house in New Orleans.
Okay, so you didn't head out of town, because I know you guys were one of the sort of hot spots.
Yes, we were, but no, I'm still here. We've been distancing at home for 8 weeks now.
Okay, we're about the same. We've been in lockdown here for about 8 weeks, and we were actually in New Orleans right before that for a conference. So we love New Orleans, by the way. It's a great town. Where are you from? Are you from New Orleans originally, or?
No, I'm actually from rural southern Oregon, about as far away from Portland as you can get in Oregon, the southwest corner of the state.
Okay, and where did you go to school? Where did you go to?
I went to undergrad at Loyola here in New Orleans, and then grad school at Claremont in Southern California.
And what was it that brought you, like, what was it that drew you from rural Oregon to Louisiana?
Well, I very much was interested in going someplace warm. My junior year of high school, it rained every day from mid-November to mid-April, and just everything was wet and cold all the time. And I was like, I just want to be someplace where it's not cold all the time. And then someplace that was relatively far away, further than an easy day's drive. So
Okay.
that meant basically the South. And I checked out a couple of places in the South, and I really liked New Orleans. And Loyola was a nice fit for me in terms of coming from a very small town. It felt like a comfortable location.
Okay. And I can definitely sympathize with the rain. We lived in Washington State, and it was like 93 days in a row or some crazy number of
It really
days.
starts to get to you, right? Like it wears on you after a while.
Definitely. So the big change to New Orleans, and so that's how you ended up in Louisiana. What sort of led you into studying what you study? Was there a particular incident or experience or something about your youth, something that drew you to what you study?
So actually, it's a story set in New Orleans also. I had met Emily Ferris at a conference, at the Southern Political Science Association conference here. And we were chatting about potentially collaborating on some research, trying to figure out what we could maybe work on. We were both really interested in local politics, but we were really interested, both of us coming from more rural areas. She grew up in rural Alabama, I grew up in rural Oregon, of thinking about sort of local politics within the rural context. And so we thought, well, like, let's just see what people have studied about sheriffs, because we know growing up in a rural place that they are really important policymakers, and maybe there is an opportunity to do some research on them. And then as we started to do sort of a basic literature review, we're like, oh, actually, there's a lot of opportunity to do research on sheriffs because political scientists basically have not done research on sheriffs. So we sort of started from the perspective of we wanted to understand local politics in rural America, and then from there started to think about what a project about sheriffs would look like. And then it has sort of taken a life of its own as we did more and more research on it.
And I appreciate that people, I think, underestimate how influential a sheriff can be. One of the things that drew me to read your guys' piece and to have an interest in this was working in a jurisdiction that I worked in Phoenix for the Phoenix Police Department. So whenever I booked someone into jail when I was a police officer, it was just with Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jail.
Yes.
And you could living in that community for an extended period of time, you realized how much power and influence this one individual had, and these sort of differences that exist between police organizations that are run by an elected official and one that's run by sort of like a professional cadre of appointed professionals.
Yes.
So it's definitely ripe for exploration, that's for sure.
Yes.
So we're also going to talk a little bit about immigration today. And in the article, you guys sort of lay out these changes that took place, and you focus primarily on like post-World War America and these changes in immigration. Can you just to frame things and give us an idea of, to set things up, what did that look like? So you have the end of the war, and then you have these changes in immigration. Can you just walk us through to set this up a little bit?
Sure, yeah. So we have a couple of concurrent changes that occur in the later half of the 20th century that become very important for thinking about immigration enforcement. So the first one is that we have a series of major national pieces of legislation that are passed that fiddle with the idea of who gets to be a documented versus undocumented immigrant in the United States, and push undocumented immigration from a clearly civil violation more into a criminal violation. So for a very long time, if you got in trouble for some kind of immigration violation, that was in essence not a criminal problem. It wasn't handled by regular law enforcement. It was not under any kind of evaluation of regular law enforcement. This was handled primarily by earlier iterations of Customs and Border Patrol or the INS. And it was not something where you're going to go to jail for that problem in itself. But in the latter half of the 20th century, we start to see changes in federal laws, and in particular, changes in a much more criminalized and tighter definition of what an undocumented immigrant is in the United States. So we have this shift that sort of creates this class of undocumented immigrants. They existed before, and certainly before the federal government treated undocumented immigrants very poorly. We could think about, for example, Chinese workers in the late 1800s and early 1900s as falling into this. We could think about Japanese internment camps as falling into the federal government treating immigrants or even the descendants of immigrants very poorly. But in the post-World War II era, we sort of start to get this much more clearly defined group of what it means to be an undocumented immigrant in the United States. And then we start to think about what it would take to potentially decrease the number of undocumented immigrants in the United States. So we have this policy efforts particularly aimed at trying to identify people that are in the country illegally and then get them out of the country. It turns out that that's actually a really hard thing to do. It's really difficult to identify who's in the country without appropriate papers. It's really difficult to find them. It's very difficult to remove them. So at this point, the federal government is interested in removing undocumented immigrants, but doesn't actually really have the enforcement capacity to do it. And so we start to get the growth of various federal agencies interested in the enforcement of identifying undocumented immigrants and removing them from the country.
So I know this is something that's relatively new, like controlling who is in a certain to this extent. I know.
To this extent, yes.
Right, it's always something that's been done, but the degree of control and identifying who is where and when, I mean, it's grown. I know my family is from a very small community, a border community in Canada, where the people for generations and generations were moving back and forth across the border. They would move seasonally, fishermen. So they would live in Massachusetts depending on during one part of the year, and then in Canada another part of the year. And it wasn't something that the government was heavily involved with. And then over time, you have more and more of an infrastructure put in place to document who should be where, and then these efforts to control it. Mm-hmm. So this apparatus is growing and evolving and becoming more and more complicated, more and more complex in the 20th century. What do you think was driving that? So what is So what are the political incentives that drive, because we see Congress heavily involved and passing this legislation and creating these institutions. What, and I know this might be a tough question to answer, but what do you think is driving that?
Well, so there are sort of xenophobic reasons for creating a more secure border and engaging more in the effort to understand who is American and who is not, right? So if we think that there's something distinctive about being an American, that means then that you have to start policing the boundaries of who gets to call themselves American or not. As a part of that, we then need to start thinking about the borders and protecting the borders so that we know that people that are inside the borders are American and people that are outside the borders are not. We also have these shifts in sort of the power of the agricultural industry in the United States. To some extent, the agricultural industry maintains its political power in this country by having a group of undocumented workers that are its chief employees, that if you have documented workers, then you need to pay them more and you need to treat them with more respect. And they're not as disposable. And so there was a significant pressure by the agricultural industry to sort of think about what it would mean to redo our immigration laws to the extent to which it could create a particular worker class that was largely made up of undocumented individuals. Often people think, oh no, the agricultural industry would love it if there was an open border and that would make everything better. But if you take away sort of the precarity of undocumented workers' lives, it makes it much more difficult to
exploit them,
yes. So that's a component to it. But we also see this, and I think, you know, Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign illustrates this, that it becomes easier to, that undocumented immigrants become an easy foil for political campaigns, that they are somehow the enemy. And it's a group that can't legally sort of speak up for itself. So there's no pushback against it. And so it's a very easy group to sort of to create an other out of and say that they are the boogeyman, they're the ones that are taking your jobs, or they're the ones that are invading our communities, or they're the ones that are bringing drugs or crime or whatever, without having to confront as a political candidate anything associated with like actually identifying a group that's bad and then having to face them and say why they're bad. So I think that there's political reasons for this, there's cultural reasons, there's economic reasons, all of them sort of are woven together to create an environment where we think about undocumented immigrants primarily being from Mexico and Central and South America, but the reality is that the largest share of undocumented immigrants in the United States right now are from Asia. They're not from Central and South America. We have this image in our mind, and part of why we have that image is that was a very useful group politically to identify as the potential enemy.
So you have this cultural reason, so like it's how we define who we are as this imagined community based on who and we let in, what types of people, what they look like, sound like, behave. That's part of defining who we are as a culture. You have these pure sort of economic incentives, you know, it's a pool of labor that can be exploited by certain institutions, and then you also have this political component. I think probably a lot to do with the industrialization and the angst that a lot of people feel. If you can say it's these people's fault, that's very useful politically. So this makes a ton of sense. And then you have sort of like post 9/11, mid 2000s, you have this change where prior to this, you have a very active Congress that shaping, writing laws, and active and engaged. And then you have what you guys refer to as like an immigration federalism sort of takes. Can you talk a little bit about this transition, how it takes place, when it takes place?
Yeah, so we have a couple of major events that happen in the 2000s that become really important for immigration enforcement. You mentioned that 9/11 happens. Obviously, 9/11 is an important political event on its own, but it's particularly important when we think about immigration enforcement because the two terrorists on the plane that crashed into the World Trade Center were immigrants that had overstayed their visas. They had overstayed their student visas. And so as a result, they were in this country they were undocumented immigrants in this country. And all of a sudden there becomes this really big interest in trying to identify undocumented immigrants in this country because they might potentially be terrorists, right? So there's this, as Kingdon would say, like a window of opportunity opens up to think about a much more aggressive enforcement of immigration policy in the United States. And so it's not necessarily that we see dramatic changes in the underlying policy structure, it's just that it becomes much easier to actually enforce the policies that are already in place. So there's two policies that emerge out of this that really contribute to what Emily and I sort of call this immigration federalism. The first is the creation of a program called 287G, and the second is the creation of a program called Secure Communities. And so both of these are located entirely within the executive branch. So these do not require active efforts by Congress. They are located within Customs and Border Patrol, and both of them are aimed at trying to get local law enforcement to participate actively in immigration enforcement in the United States. So within this context, again, thinking back to sort of one of the major shifts that happened in the later half of the 20th century, the federal government would like to be really engaged in immigration enforcement, but it turns out it's really hard to do immigration enforcement. And in order for the federal government to really do immigration enforcement in the manner that it wants to, it would need to just a massive group of employees, far larger than say Customs and Border Patrol has now or ICE has now, even now when Customs and Border Patrol and ICE are at the largest that they've ever been, right? So we would need tripling or quadrupling the number of agents that work for Customs and Border Patrol, for example. So if you're the federal government and you can't enforce this policy yourself, you look around and think, well, who could enforce this policy for me? Well, local government could potentially enforce this policy for me. And in particular, local law enforcement could enforce this policy for me. And so they create these policies that are aimed, in the case of 287G, at deputizing local law enforcement and making them officially members of Customs and Border Patrol or ICE, or in the case of Secure Communities, using the existing information infrastructure that exists that local jails rely on as a mechanism for immigration enforcement. And in this circumstance, we see in particular the fingerprinting database that the federal government uses that local law enforcement accesses as a primary tool that the federal government uses to enforce immigration policy at the local level.
Okay, so the study that you're gonna tell us a little bit about that you guys conducted is examining the way that, so what, how sheriffs are going to, what variables you expect might indicate whether or not a sheriff is or is not going to engage in these enforcement actions. Am I saying this correctly? Yeah. So you talk about individual characteristics, local demographics, and institutional characteristics. Can you talk a little bit about these predictors, these things, these characteristics? Can you talk a little bit about them?
Yeah, so we look at who the sheriffs are, the communities that they serve in, and sort of the structures of their offices, and in particular, the sort of state level policies that exist, or federal policies that exist. So when we think about sort of who sheriffs are, we might think about some of their characteristics being important, like we might expect for their race to matter. You know, theories of representation would suggest that maybe if you had a Latino sheriff, that sheriff would be more interested in a compassionate immigration policy over a really punitive immigration policy. Or you might expect that the sheriff's partisanship might matter. So we know that today, Democrats and Republicans in the general population have very different views about immigration on average. So we might also expect for that to apply for sheriffs. The factor that we looked at that we were particularly interested in is whether or not the sheriff's attitudes that they themselves hold about immigrants then translate into policies that the sheriff's office puts into place. And here is one place where we think it's really important to think about sheriffs as a unique office, because sheriffs are both a bureaucratic employee in some ways, right? One thing that sheriffs do is they run jails, but they also engage in law enforcement, that sort of the policy implementation of law enforcement. But they're also executives, because they're elected and they sort of can't be told what to do by other local elected officials. They're in charge of their own offices. And so we might expect that an executive's attitudes about a particular group of people, for example, or type of policy might then translate into the actual policy that's put into place, because they're both this executive and bureaucrat at the same time. We also, though, think that it might be that if you live in a community with a lot of immigrants, then either you engage in a lot of enforcement or you engage in no enforcement. If you live in a liberal place, that might shape the type of enforcement that happens. If you live close to the border, that if you are a sheriff that represents a community close to the border. We also think that there are some institutional characteristics like the size of the sheriff's office that matters. This is, again, something that is really interesting with studying sheriffs, is that some of them have two employees and some of them have 20,000 employees, like the sheriff of Los Angeles County is in charge of 45,000 individuals, right? So there's an enormous amount of variation. That probably affects the types of policies that an office has in place. And so in that context, we might expect, for example, that in a really highly professionalized office, like the office that the sheriff of Los Angeles County, you have to be professionalized to have that many employees.
Right.
We wouldn't necessarily expect that the sheriff's attitude would matter so much, because there's so many policies that are sort of in place. But in a smaller place where the sheriff gets to sort of set policy as he or she goes, I should say, actually, as he goes, because there are almost no women that are sheriffs, then we might expect in that circumstance that the sheriff's attitudes about immigrants or immigration policy more generally would be really important for affecting the policy outcomes.
So you talk about how like maybe a larger, more professional sheriff's department would be like an insulating factor, preventing like these ideologies from spilling over. And can you talk a little bit about what the difference is with, like I say, like where I worked for the Phoenix Police Department, and the Sheriff's Department, Sheriff Joe, and our department was we advertised, hey, we don't care about your immigration status. Mm. Call us. We want your future report crimes. We need you to be witnesses. What role does like a city manager or a mayor or a city council that is in charge of and you have a process where someone is appointed? I know you've already sort of explained it's this dual role that this person fills as a sheriff, where they're both Can you talk a little bit about that? How by injecting, because we think, because intuitively, people may think, oh, wow, it's democratic. The people are selecting this person, whereas this is being appointed. Can you talk a little bit about how that works as an insulator?
Sure. Yeah. So sheriffs are almost universally elected. There's some exceptions. The state of Connecticut has appointed sheriffs. Alaska and Hawaii don't have sheriffs because they don't have counties, essentially. And then there are a few places across the United States that have an appointed sheriff. But in general, sheriffs are elected. They're directly elected by the population, by the county that they serve in. And theoretically, that means that there's accountability to the citizens. Practically, though, there's really high incumbency rates for county sheriffs. There's low levels of political competition. So even when you don't have an incumbent necessarily running for re-election, a pattern that you often see is the incumbent sort of anoints a successor that is going to take over, and that person then is elected without a lot of political competition. So theoretically, there is this mechanism that's in place that could serve as a check on a poorly behaving sheriff. We have not seen a lot of examples of the voting public being a check on a poorly behaving sheriff. So Joe Arpaio is a very good example of this. He was reelected several times, even in an environment where the public was sort of universally either disgusted by or ambivalent towards his policies that he had put into place. The reality is that most people don't have any idea who their sheriff is, and they pay no attention to the policies that their sheriff is engaging in. And certainly for a person that is not sort of invested in questions about immigration policy, they wouldn't know or care about what a sheriff's views are about immigrants or the policies that they have been put into place to deal with documented or undocumented immigrants in the population. So this exists in theory, but the reality is that the vote is very rarely a tool that's used to hold sheriffs accountable. In comparison to, say, an appointed police chief, in that circumstance, they're not directly accountable to the public, but they are accountable to a city manager and an elected city council and elected mayor who are interested in there being effective crime policy in their city, because they're worried that if crime gets out of control or if people have bad experiences with the police department, then they're going to hold the mayor and city council accountable for that, even if they're only sort of indirectly accountable for it. So in that circumstance, you often see that police chiefs are, their behavior is more regulated by the city manager or the city council and mayor than anything that we see on the sheriff's side, because there isn't this sort of daily accountability where a sheriff has to report into other people about why he's doing what he's doing.
It's this professional accountability. You're accountable to somebody, whereas within an election, the accountability just, it's just not the same.
You know, accountability via elections requires that you have an informed public that cares about the issues and is willing to make choices based on those issues.
So you mean we would need to live in a functioning democracy for that to work?
Theoretically, yes, that would be a requirement.
Okay.
But, you know, I do want to say there have been some circumstances recently where there have been effective challenges mounted against sheriffs around questions of immigration enforcement and jail management. And we've seen, you know, broad changes in who's elected to political office. So North Carolina sort of had this wave of sheriffs were, you know, incumbent sheriffs that had been in power for a long time lost to challengers. And often they lost because the sheriff in power had very strict or very punitive policies in place in their jail or around cooperation with ICE and Customs and Border Patrol.
So it can, it is possible. So yeah. Not lose all hope.
No.
So you're painting a picture of this growing apparatus designed to control immigration, then a diffusion of that power to local law enforcement, and many of these are these sheriffs who their political and personal ideologies can bleed into how these, or if these are enforced. Mm-hmm. How much power are we talking about? So you take a sheriff in an American county, and how much power, can you just talk a little bit about how much political power, both within immigration and other issues? You talked about this earlier, saying people don't realize how much power these people have. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the sort of kicker is with all of this that for many people that live in the United States, their sheriff is actually probably the most powerful local elected official in their lives. They just don't really know it. So in general, sheriffs run jails. That we know that. That's sort of a consistent task across the United States, that all sheriffs run jails. In running those jails, they have an enormous amount of discretion. Just jail management itself requires making a lot of choices about the degree to which you are going to punish people for bad behavior, the types of resources that you're going to offer them. Are you going to allow them to access library books? Are you going to allow them to make free phone calls to family and friends? All of these are policy choices that sheriffs make and make largely with autonomy. So there's not other people sort of regulating what they do in their jails. But the other thing that sheriffs do is that they regulate sort of who comes into their jail. So in many places, sheriffs are primary law enforcement offices. So they run a whole office that has deputies under them, and they engage in a variety of really important choices about the law enforcement policy that they're going to engage in their communities. So we can think about this from everything from whether or not you choose to sort of decriminalize minor drug possessions in your community, what kinds of support you provide to victims of crimes in your community, what kinds of trainings you have your law enforcement deputies engaged in, and the degree to which you allow state and federal officers to use your law enforcement apparatus to enforce state and federal laws. So when we talk about immigration, are you somebody that allows CPS to regularly check the immigration status of individuals that you interact with as a law enforcement apparatus? So in the article that Emily and I wrote, we asked sheriffs sort of, what is your typical policy about when you check immigration status of individuals? And we know that generally most law enforcement officers agree that we should be checking the immigration status of individuals that have been charged with crimes, particularly felonies. So if you have been booked into a jail and you've been charged with a crime and you're going to be fingerprinted associated with that, being charged with that crime, then you should be run through the federal database that checks your immigration status. But there's an enormous amount of interaction that individuals have with law enforcement that occurs before somebody is booked into jail, and for far minor instances than being booked into jail. So we asked sheriffs whether or not they check people's immigration status when they're stopped for traffic violations, when they report crimes as witnesses and victims of crimes, thinking that these are times where there's a lot of discretion about whether or not you're going to check somebody's immigration status. It's also a point where we know, particularly for the traffic violations, that a lot of racial profiling occurs by law enforcement. And this is in some ways sort of a mechanism of racial profiling, whether or not you check someone's immigration status. So this is an example of the types of discretion that sheriffs have, but sheriffs also have a lot of discretion about the services that they offer. So whether or not they would accept a Mexican ID, a consular identification as a form of identification, whether or not they provide Spanish translation services, these types of sort of more proactive services that a sheriff's office can engage in sort of represent the, that there's a broad range of policies that these individuals can put into place or not that would allow for an immigrant community to interface more easily or more difficultly with local law enforcement.
So you guys operationalize this, these, how people could exercise these, this power, and you survey people from sheriffs around the country, and you're trying to measure to determine whether or not these individual beliefs translate into action. So first of all, how many people did you survey?
Just over 500 sheriffs. Okay. So we sent out a survey to all sheriffs, and about 500 of them, 536 or so, responded.
And what were your sort of central findings? When you broke this down, you analyzed it. What did you find?
So the big finding is that sheriffs that they themselves report having more negative attitudes about immigrants or supporting more punitive national immigration policy are more likely to report that they check immigration status of people that are witnesses to crimes or victims of crimes or during routine engagements like traffic stops. There's no difference though in terms of attitudes in that sort of far end of immigration check. So whether or not you check someone's immigration status when they've been charged with a felony.
That's kind of universal?
Universal. Sheriffs just report, yes, all sheriffs report, yes, we check someone's immigration status. It's in this sort of period where these times that are far more discretionary, where the sheriff's individual attitudes seem to really play a role in their choices that they're making about immigration policy.
So it doesn't bleed over where there's sort of consensus where citizens would expect. Like, if someone is arrested for an armed robbery, it makes sense to me that the officials that have them in custody would run every kind of check that they could possibly run. But if someone conducts a traffic stop, I wouldn't expect the police officer to run them through an immigration check. It doesn't seem like there would be a reason to do it. What you're finding is that when you look across the country, these different departments, that when the sheriff expresses a certain type of ideology, that is bleeding through, and they are conducting in these unusual sort of circumstances.
And it is, I want to point out, it's a fairly low level of engaging these behaviors, right? So it's, you know, under 20% of sheriffs are reporting that they check somebody's immigration status, for example, when they're ticketed for a traffic violation. But there still are major differences within that 20%. That 20% is made up largely of sheriffs that have negative attitudes themselves about immigrants.
And this, the thing that really made, you know, drew my attention to this topic was that there are implications that you wouldn't even expect. Like, having worked in a community with a large number of undocumented people and having to conduct investigations as a detective, where you're dependent upon people reporting a crime, people sticking around to give you information, things when people don't feel when people lose trust in the police and the government, they're more likely to take things into their own hands. I mean, if you look at homicide rates across the Western world for the last 400 years, when public trust is low, people take things into their own hands. So when you alienate a community, there can be real implications.
You also think about, you know, one of the challenges is that Most people don't know the difference between, say, a sheriff and a police chief, and they don't know the difference between being interviewed by a sheriff's deputy or a police officer. And so if you have a sheriff that's engaging in these types of behaviors and word gets out that that's happening, right, that the police are checking immigration status when you, say, report a crime or when you're a victim of a crime, then what the sort of downstream effects we would assume are that people will begin to distrust all law enforcement. And as a result, then you have these consequences that you talk about of it becomes incredibly difficult to investigate crimes, or it becomes very unlikely that people will report crimes, particularly minor crimes. So you might see that people just don't report things like minor burglary or domestic violence or sexual assault because they don't trust that they're going to be able to interface with law enforcement.
And as a police officer, I can think of one that really stands out to me, an experience I had where I was involved in an actual, I responded to a domestic violence call while I was a patrol officer. And in the act of defending, a person had to discharge my firearm and shoot somebody at work. And the person who was standing behind me was the only independent witness to why I had done what I had done. And when I was being interviewed by the homicide investigator later that evening, they couldn't find this witness. The person had, they found them later on, but this person was undocumented. They were a victim of domestic violence. And when the police showed up, and they fled, they didn't feel safe because, and when they were interviewed, they said, the scared Sheriff Joe was going to deport me.
Yes.
So like, it's incredible how much of an impact this has on the, on a community, like at a cultural level. Mm-hmm. So it's terrifying. Can you talk a little bit about, so this is what you're finding that's fascinating. What sort of policy recommendations, if you were dictator Perpetua and you could set out some solutions and say, here's the changes that we need to make, or maybe something that's feasible, like what type of policy recommendations would you have?
So in general, I think that we should get out of the business of criminalizing immigration status. I don't think that it should be the role of law enforcement to engage in immigration status checks or evaluations. Because once you get law enforcement involved, then that sets up the incentive structure to do things like this. And the other sort of wrinkle to this that I think about a lot is that sheriffs are also heavily incentivized financially to cooperate with immigration and customs enforcement. Sheriffs are generally, depends on the state, but generally paid a rate per person per day in their jail. And often the rate that they're paid by the state is very low. I live in Louisiana. Louisiana is notoriously miserly in what they pay sheriffs to hold people in jails. And so often this involves the sheriff trying to find alternative places for money because they're not actually being paid enough to cover the basic expenses of holding people in jail. Immigration and Customs Enforcement pays a much higher rate to hold people in jail. And so if you have an environment where immigration enforcement has been criminalized, and sheriffs are financially incentivized to cooperate with immigration and customs enforcement, this then creates a avenue for local law enforcement to say, well, the best thing for me financially is to check everybody's immigration status and hold anybody that might possibly be in violation of their immigration status for ICE or CPS to come and get them. That is not an ideal circumstance if we're trying to think about how to have law enforcement that's trusted by the community. And so you have these sort of these two interests, say one of your interests is immigration enforcement, and the other is having sort of trust in law enforcement at direct odds with each other. So first recommendation is sort of decriminalize immigration enforcement. The second major recommendation that I would have is for the sort of finances of jails to be more equitably allocated, particularly across states. One thing that we see is that some states are really good at paying for the actual cost of holding people in jails. And this is particularly important in circumstances where sheriffs have sort of come to be de facto mental health care providers in their communities. And it can become very expensive for sheriffs to humanely hold individuals in their jails that are there primarily because they have mental health problems, not because they're actual criminals. Or they've become sort of social service providers because they are the ones that arrest people for sort of homelessness, et cetera. And so if we had a sort of a more robust social service enterprise that included funds directly to sheriffs for dealing with these types of things, then we would sort of bypass some of these incentives. The third policy recommendation that I have is around training. So sheriffs are generally, when I talk to sheriffs, they want more training. They don't know how to do a lot of the policy tasks that they have been granted. And as a result, they rely on whatever training is available, which means that they want to participate in things like 287G because it means free training for their deputies, and they don't have the funds to provide good training. And so they, yes, absolutely, I'll have CPS come and do a training for me for free, or maybe they'll even pay me. Like, that's amazing. So if we had sort of a better apparatus for thinking about how to interact with immigrant communities and produce policy around interacting with immigrant communities that law enforcement could use, that I think would also sort of bypass some of the incentives to participate in these types of programs.
So it's moving back to making immigration violations a civil matter like they were in the past, decoupling local law enforcement from the immigration function. So that might also include beefing up, I don't know how that would look, but decoupling those. And then the other thing you talked about was alleviating some of the pressure, so like that they're not having to incarcerate people for mental health issues. We could maybe, yeah, I don't know, treat their mental health issues or addiction issues.
Yes.
And then the last bit, if you could touch on one more time, was
Just thinking about sort of alternatives to training.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So again, it's kind of that there's an incentive structure being created by the federal government whereby you can incarcerate these people and make more money incarcerating them. You can get your people training and resources that mm-hmm. they might not otherwise get. So there needs to be a bunch of different things that take place in order to make these changes. What about the idea of the sheriff? So the idea that in 2020, in such a complex society, that we still have these guys with the 10-gallon bucket hats yelling crazy things on television. Do you think that the time of the sheriff has passed, or is this something that we're going to be stuck with? Or
So practically, we are stuck with them because they are written into more than half of state constitutions. There's also sort of practical issues of if we move to an appointed system, who would appoint them? So would that be county commissioners? What if you are in a place where there aren't county commissioners? This governor, are you going to give the governor that much power, right? So in Texas, are you going to give Greg Abbott the power to appoint 286 sheriffs that all have enormous amounts of discretion and autonomy? Like, you know, that doesn't seem right to me. That And so the sort of question is then like compared to what, right? So if, is it, should we have elected sheriffs? I don't know. I haven't yet sort of fully decided that. But I don't know that I have been presented with an alternative that's any better than what we have.
And it's reality. It's what we've got.
Yes. And so then the sort of second choice is that we do a much better job of thinking about political competition for these offices.
Right.
And there's a little bit of effort at this, but for a long time, these offices have just sort of been ignored by political activists at the local level. They haven't even been on the radar. So we have city council races that are $1 million city council races for a seat that basically has no power. And meanwhile, there's an incumbent sheriff that has enormous amount of power that like his office is like three doors down and everybody's ignoring him. So right. Thinking about political accountability as being the avenue towards change in these offices. And that would be what I would suggest is if you're interested in changing this, then find somebody to run for sheriff against your incumbent sheriff.
Okay, so if you're not happy with your sheriff, find somebody to run against them.
Yes.
So I guess, it is what it is. It's so complicated, and American law enforcement is such an intricate patchwork of organizations and overlapping responsibility that it's almost like so complicated that you could never reform it.
Very difficult to have sort of a broad reform of it.
Yeah, and it's 18,000 plus different agencies. We don't even know how many police agencies there are in the United States, but it just seems like no matter what the issue in policing, I always hear as an obstacle to reform this patchwork. It makes it difficult, but there are some positive things to say about it as well. I have one more question. I've had you on here for quite a while. I've just been thinking about the effort that's going to be required to restart the economy. There's going to be the contact tracing, all of the work that's going to need to be done. Have you thought at all about what role or what type of influence America sheriffs may have, how this takes place? Can you talk a little bit about that if you've thought about it?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a couple of things that are happening that involve sheriffs. The first is that in some states, you see that sheriffs have said that they're not going to enforce stay-at-home orders. That is sort of broadly a part of a more general political movement by sheriffs, the National Sovereignty Movement, Constitutional Sheriffs, where they bristle at state efforts, any kind of state efforts to tell them what to do. That perhaps would be a different podcast. We could talk about that at some point. There's also, though, this component to restarting the economy that I think is really interesting, which is sort of right now, I'm in New Orleans, so I'll use it as an example. New Orleans has essentially like decriminalized drugs, right? Because we're not engaging in any kind of drug enforcement. They've released all nonviolent offenders from the jail. So the jail is at its lowest level in 40 years of people in the jail. We're basically like to a system where the sheriff is only responsible for really violent offenders at this point. And sort of thinking about whether or not there are law enforcement officers that take this as an opportunity to say like, well, like what if we just like kept doing this, right? Like what if we sort of decided that we weren't going to criminally enforce a lot of these nonviolent offenses in our communities? What would it look like if we only tried to maintain a jail population of a third of what we normally do? I just think that's a really interesting thought exercise of sort of what law enforcement, what kinds of decisions law enforcement could make right now, moving forward, using this as sort of a a structural interruption to then really reform what law enforcement looks like in their communities. Sheriffs have the opportunity to actually do that, right? Because they have all of this autonomy, a sheriff could decide, like, hey, guess what? My life is a lot easier if I only have 60 people instead of 300 people in jail every day. Like, what if I just sort of try to keep it at this? So I think it's, you know, nothing about this is great, but I think the sort of opportunities that it presents are really interesting.
Yeah, never let a crisis go to waste. I mean, it's a perfect, it's an excuse if you're a political figure, which sheriffs are, to make changes. You know, have this major disruptive event, and it gives you, you know, the space, and hopefully that space can be filled with some positive change and not just horrible things like
that.
So I want to thank you so much for, do you have any sort of final thoughts or any sort of things that you want to touch on before we...
Just an encouragement to all listeners out there to find out who your sheriff is and when they're going to be reelected.
Okay, so get out there and be politically active. Thank you so much for your time. I think this is like a topic that is not nearly enough attention is given to. So I really appreciate your guys' work on this. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Be safe.
Yeah, you too.